The Birds by Bruno Schultz. Along came the yellow and thoroughly boring days of winter. A ragged, sparse, and undersized cloth of snow was spread over the russet-hued earth. On many of the roofs it was insufficient, and so they remained black or rust-coloured, shingle or thatched arcs concealing the smoke-blackened expanses of the attics within them, black, charred cathedrals bristling with their ribs of rafters, crossbeams and spars, dark lungs of the winter gales. Every daybreak revealed new chimney stacks and chimney pots sprung up in the night, poking out through the night's gale, the black pipes of diabolical organs. Chimney sweeps could not drive away the crows that perched in the evenings in the form of living black leaves on the branches of the trees by the church. They took off again, fluttering, only to cling again at last, each to its own place on its own branch. And at daybreak they flew up in great flocks, clouds of soot, flakes of lampblack, undulating and fantastic, smearing the dull yellow streaks of daybreak with their twinkling cawing. The days hardened in the cold and boredom like last year's bread loaves. They were cut with blunt knives, without appetite, in idle sleepiness. Father no longer left the house. He lit the stoves. He studied the fire's never-fathomable essence. He savoured the salty, metallic taste and smoky aroma of its winter flames, a cool caress of salamanders licking at the shiny soot in the throat of the chimney. With enthusiasm, in those days, he carried out all the repairs in the upper reaches of the room. At all times of day, he could be seen crouching at the top of a stepladder as he tinkered with something near the ceiling, near the cornices of the high windows, or around the counterweights and chains of the hanging lamps. In the manner of house painters, he employed his ladder as an enormous pair of stilts, and he felt good in that bird's-eye perspective within reach of the ceiling's painted skies, arabesques, and birds. He withdrew further and further from affairs of practical life. When Mother, full of worries and anxiety over his condition, tried to draw him into a conversation about business matters or the bills due at the end of the month, he listened to her distractedly, thoroughly vexed, and with twitches in his absent face. He might suddenly interrupt her with an entreating gesture of the hand in order to scurry over to a corner of the room and fix his ear to a chink in the floor. And, with the index fingers of both hands upraised, indicating the most supreme importance of the investigation, to monitor. At that time, we did not yet understand the sad background to those eccentricities, the lamentable complex that was ripening in the deep. Mother had no influence over him. He bestowed, on the other hand, great reverence and attention upon Adela. Her cleaning of the room was a great and important ceremony to him, which he never neglected to bear witness to, scrutinizing each of Adela's manipulations with a combination of fear and a delighted shudder. He ascribed a deeper, symbolic meaning to her every action. When the girl pushed a long-handled broom across the floor, with youthful and bold thrusts, it was almost beyond his endurance. Tears flowed from his eyes at such moments. His face was choked with silent laughter, and his body shook with a delighted, orgasmic spasm. His sensitivity to tickles approached madness. It was enough for Adela to point a finger at him with a motion suggesting tickling, and already he was fleeing in a wild panic through all the rooms, fastening the doors behind him, to collapse at last on his stomach on the bed, twisting in convulsions of laughter under the influence of the particular internal vision that he could not endure. Thanks to this, Adela had an almost unbounded authority over Father. During this time, we noticed for the first time in Father a passionate interest in animals. At first, it was the passion of a hunter and an artist combined. Perhaps it was also a deeper, zoological liking of a creature for related and yet so different forms of life, and experimentation in untested registers of existence. Only in a later phase did this affair take the disturbing, tangled, and deeply sinful turn against nature, which it is better not to bring to the light of day. It began with the incubation of birds' eggs. With a great outlay of effort and expense, Father obtained fertilized birds' eggs from Hamburg, Holland, and African zoological stations, and set enormous Belgian hens to incubating them. It was a most interesting procedure for me, too, that hatching out of nestlings, real anomalies of shape and coloration. It was improbable to envision in these monsters with their enormous fantastic beaks, which were torn wide open the moment they were born, hissing greedily from the abysses of their throats, in those salamanders with the weak, naked bodies of hunchbacks, the peacocks, pheasants, woodgrouse, and condors they were to become. Placed in baskets, in cotton wool, this dragon brood raised up their blind and wall-eyed heads on thin necks, squawking voicelessly from their dumb throats. My father walked along the shelves in a green apron, like the gardener along his cactus frames, and enticed from nothingness those blind blisters pulsating with life, those infirm abdomens taking in the external world only by means of feeding, whose growths of life scrabbling gropingly towards the light. During the next few weeks, while these blind buds of life were bursting into the light, the rooms became filled with coloured murmuring, the tinkling twittering of their new inhabitants. They perched on the wooden curtain pelmets and the mouldings on the wardrobes, and nested in the thicket of the tin branches and many-armed arabesques of the hanging lamps. As Father studied his great ornithological compendiums and browsed through their colourful plates, it seemed as though those newly fledged phantasms had flown out from them and filled the room with colourful fluttering, slivers of crimson and shreds of sapphire, vertices and silver. At feeding time, they comprised a varicoloured, surging patch on the floor, a living carpet which fell to pieces upon anyone's incautious entry, rest asunder into animated flowers fluttering in the air to seat themselves at last in the upper regions of the room. A certain condor remains especially in my memory, an enormous bird with a naked neck and a face wrinkled and rank with growths. It was a lean ascetic, a Buddhist lama, full of imperturbable dignity in its whole demeanour, comporting itself with the iron ceremony of its great tribe. When it sat opposite Father, motionless in its monumental posture of immemorial Egyptian pagan gods, its eye clouded over with a white film which reached from the side to the pupil, to enclose itself fully in the contemplation of its dignified solitude. It appeared, with its stone-hard profile, to be the elder brother of my father. The very same substance of the body, the tendons and the wrinkled hard skin, the very same dried and bony face, and those very same deep horny orbits. Even Father's long and thin hands, hardened into knots and with curling nails, had their analogon in the condor's talons. I could not resist the impression, when I saw it thus fallen asleep, that I had before me a mummy, a dried up and thereby shrunken mummy of my father. Nor do I think that this astonishing resemblance has escaped my mother's attention, although we never pursued the topic. It is characteristic that the condor, in common with my father, used his chamber pot. Not confining himself to the incubation of ever newer prototypes, my father arranged ornithological weddings in the attic. He dispatched matchmakers and tethered enticing, ardent fiancées in the gaps and hollows of the attic, and the roof of our house, an enormous shingle-span roof, became, in effect, a veritable bird's inn, a Noah's Ark to which all kinds of feathered creatures flocked from faraway parts. Even long after the liquidation of the avian farm, this tradition regarding our house persisted in the world of birds, and many a time during the period of the springtime migration, whole hosts of cranes, pelicans, peacocks, and every kind of bird descended onto our roof. This venture, however, by and by, after its brief splendidness, took a sad turn, for it shortly proved that a final translocation of father was required to two rooms in the attic which served as lumber rooms. It was from there that the confused clamour of the birds' voices now reached us in the early dawn. The wooden boxes of attic rooms, augmented by the resonance of the expansive roof, sounded from top to bottom with noise, fluttering, crowing, hooting, and gurgling. Thus, father was lost to our sight for several weeks. Only seldom would he come down to the apartment, and only then were we able to perceive that he was diminished, as though he had lost flesh and shrunk. Occasionally, through forgetfulness, he started up from his chair at table, and, waving his arms like wings, let out protracted hoots, while a cloud of leucoma came to his eyes. And then, embarrassed, he laughed together with us, and tried to turn this incident into a joke. On one particular occasion, Adela, during her general housework, unexpectedly appeared in Father's ornithological kingdom. Standing in the doorway, she wrung her hands at the stench rising in the air, as well as the heaps of excrement covering the floorboards, tables, and furniture. Quickly decisive, she opened the window, and, making use of her long brushes, she set the whole avian mass into rotation. An infernal storm cloud of feathers, wings, and screeches arose, in which Adela, looking like a furious maenad enveloped in the whirling of her thyrsus, danced a dance of destruction. My father, waving his arms, tried to raise himself into the air along with his flock of birds. Slowly, the winged storm cloud thinned, until at last Adela stood alone on the battlefield, exhausted and breathing hard, and my father, ready with an air of perturbation and shame to resign himself to every capitulation. A moment later, my father stepped down from the stairway of his dominion, a broken man, an exile king who had lost his throne and his reign.